begin. We did get you to NIDA at the end of our last session.
Right.
And so I'd like you to begin by naming, if you can, the main contributions of your administration.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there were several. First of all, I established a medication development division. And I called it a medication development division because I did not want to have a drug development division at the National Institute on Drug Abuse, for obvious reasons. And the reason why we had to do that was that the pharmaceutical industry does not see addiction as a very lucrative market, with the possible exception of tobacco smoking. Even alcohol has been somewhat shunned because of the predominance of AA and its credos that, in the past at least, had been very anti-pharmacological interventions. And so we felt the necessity to actually try to develop ourselves or to work with smaller industry that might be willing to take these projects on and to stimulate interest in this area. And because of that, we got a medication that Jerry Jaffe and I had originally done research on called LAM way back in the early 1970s. Finally, like almost 20 years later, we got it onto the market. And unfortunately, it later was found to have some potential toxic effects on the heart, and it's not been restricted, but you have to do EKGs every 3 months, and so it's dead. I mean, you know, because we can't afford to do that. But nevertheless, we did get that out on the market, and I think that the medication development division has been important, and certainly in the development of buprenorphine, very active in that area. Secondly, the other thing which goes to the opposite extreme was that ethnography, which is street anthropology or urban anthropology, had been largely neglected by former directors of NIDA, and I felt that they had a very vital role as a surveillance mechanism, and also to get a better handle on the who is not in. I mean, we only see people who are in treatment. And they may not be anything like the people who are out on the street using drugs who are not coming into treatment. And so they could be very vital there. And then, of course, the issue of AIDS. My predecessor had been reluctant to take on the issue of AIDS because NIDA's budget was relatively small, and he thought that other NIH institutes that were concerned with infectious diseases should do that. On the other hand, I recognized, and as I'm sure he did too, but it became increasingly
clear. You're talking about
Bill Pollard? Yes, yeah. Became increasingly clear that HIV infection, I mean, a principal vector of spread of HIV infection was through sharing of needles. But even more tragically, people who were having heterosexual contact with individuals who had acquired the disease through sharing needles. And these were people who were not drug users, usually women. So we used ethnographers not only for surveillance, but also to be able to get the message out onto the street about HIV infection, how it was transmitted and so forth, and began very actively to try and get individuals to use condoms. And secondly, we wanted to set up needle exchange programs, but we were forbidden to do that in the administration in which I worked. But we were allowed to pass out bottles of bleach and to teach people how to clean their syringes and needles so that they would disinfect them. Tragically, we found out later that that was not very effective, because in order for the bleach to kill the virus, has to penetrate the red blood cells that are oftentimes left in the needles. And that takes a minimum of 60 seconds. And people who are waiting to get a shot of heroin, we ask them in mock situations, okay, show us how you do it. And we were lucky if they did it for 20 seconds. Mm-hmm. And so it was just, you know, sad, but we weren't, I mean, we tried. The reason why we could not use needle exchange programs was because in the Drug Abuse Act of, I think, 1988, they specifically stated no federal funds will be used for the support of needle exchange programs until the Surgeon General certifies two things. Number one, that it decreases the spread of HIV infection, and number two, that it decreases drug abuse, which is, yeah, of course, stupid. I mean, I would have bought it. They said it does not increase drug abuse, because many people were concerned if we made it safer for people to use drugs, more people would use drugs. So the term harm minimization, if you use that in the federal government at that time, and even now to some extent, you would have to wash your mouth out with soap if you didn't get fired for it. It's just a dirty word. But so up until very recently, but anyway, so ethnography and the impact and HIV infection, taking that on as a major part of NIDA. The other thing that happened while I was at NIDA, of course, was the tragic death of Len Bias, the Maryland football player. And I think that the full realization of the impact of crack cocaine was just became horrendous. A tragedy that occurred with crack cocaine, and which I feel somewhat responsible for, is the fact that I thought that since crack can be smoked and has the same addictive properties as intravenous cocaine, that it was more dangerous than powder in the sense that the population at risk for using it was much greater. Yes. Because lots of people don't want to put a needle in their arm, but they'd be willing to smoke something. And I said that in front of the Commission for Mandatory Sentencing, and then Congress got together and made this horrendous, stupid difference between the amount of crack cocaine that you possessed in order to get a minimum 10-year sentence and the amount of powdered cocaine. I mean, after all, powdered cocaine can be converted in a few minutes to crack cocaine.
Yes.
You know, with a 95% yield. So, I mean, you know, just because I got powdered cocaine in my pocket doesn't mean I'm not going to convert it when I get a chance into crack. But what has resulted from that, as you're well aware, is that since crack cocaine is distributed largely in African-American neighborhoods, we have filled up our prisons with African-American individuals who were caught with crack cocaine, and those with powdered cocaine, which are largely Caucasian, get far lesser sentences for even much greater amounts. There's a hundredfold difference between the amounts. And I've gone back to the Mandatory Commission, and others have, and they agree, but it has not resulted in a policy change.
Yes.
Or a legislative change. I beg your pardon. They said they would change it. They would increase the penalties for powder up to those of crack.
So much for absolution.
Right, yes. So I still feel that I think one of the reasons why crack cocaine did not take off the way that I thought it might potentially, it may come back and do that, is because the original powder cocaine came in through the jet set and was glamorized. Crack cocaine was shown in the poorest neighborhoods of our city, used by unattractive people. Mm-hmm. And it just was never glamorized. And I think that if it had come in through Hollywood, it would have been an entirely different story.
Well, what about meth?
Well, meth.
In those terms.
Well, yeah, meth is interesting. It like all drugs, it's had its ups and downs. It was down, was way up in the 60s, and you know, when the speed kills kind of adage was around. And it was associated in at one time, you know, in the Haight-Ashbury district with the you know, the Festival of Love and Summer of Love and so forth. Unfortunately, The phrase speed kills did not mean that people were dying. It meant that it killed their spirit, and it killed the entire movement of that generation, because it is a very addictive drug with very dire consequences when you continue to take it. I just came from doing a poster on methamphetamine
yes.
toxicity in
yes.
humans.
anyway,
it then became, well, largely bikers, the motorcycle gangs began to traffic in it, and, you know, again, I guess that has an appeal to some, but I don't know how wide that appeal is, but it certainly is an appeal for some. I don't think that it ever took off quite as much as, I don't think it was glamorized to quite the same extent that powder cocaine was, with all the movies and so forth. But secondly, now it's, of course, methamphetamine abuse is coming back currently, and coming back largely in rural areas because it can be manufactured out of the same stuff you get from fertilizer. And I was with a narc the other day who said he could go in into any motel room and within 8 hours manufacture X number of grams of methamphetamine and be out of there, you know, and nobody'd be the wiser. You can go on the internet and find all the ingredients and the equipment you need to do it. And it's becoming widespread again, more in rural areas than in the city.
So. Okay, so we've got your main contributions, and the medication development division was an intramural.
No.
What I'd like you to do is, you inherited the ARC, but
right.
you also radically expanded the extramural program.
Correct.
Could you tell me something about the dynamics?
Well, let me first of all say that when I arrived at NIDA in 1986, it had a budget of around $85 million. When I left the directorship in 92, it had a budget of $415 million. Nobody could have been at NIDA at a more joyous time because, and I always facetiously say I take credit for all the increase. Obviously, crack cocaine, the death of Len Bias, AIDS, and all of these things were responsible for the increase in the budget at NIDA. But it allowed us to expand both our intramural and our extramural programs so that we could begin to fund things across a broad variety of areas. And it was just an incredible period of time. When I first arrived, I was there a few weeks, and I was told, what would you do if you had $60 million more a year? Budget's $85 million. I called in the lead people at night and I said, okay, guys, we have to have a paper out in 2 days detailing what we'll do with $60 million more. We stayed up overnight for 2 days and we got it out. Well, of course, largely what we did was to take things that people had developed in the past that they wanted to do that could have never been funded and repackage those into a coherent paper and got it in, and we got to $60 million. You know?
Yeah.
And then the word went out, and we got more grants than we could possibly handle. We didn't even have the space to put them. So one of my friends who was working at NIDA for a year on an IPA, Lou Harris from the University.
I'm interviewing him
Medical
today.
College of Virginia. He came in on the weekend and built shelves. Unfortunately, when we put all these heavy grants on them, the shelves collapsed, so I had to rebuild them. And then he said, Bob, can I take over the review process because your staff is just overwhelmed? And he did, and thank God, because we got like three times the number of grants that NIDA had ever gotten when they found out we had this $60 million extra, and we were able to successfully carry it off.
And how can you tell me something about how you decided which areas to prioritize, how you organized this seeming deluge?
Yeah. I guess what I would say is that I have always looked at the problem of drug abuse as the problems of drug abuse, and therefore felt that we really had to have an across the board from molecular biology through ethnography, sociology, we had to attack the problems of drug abuse at all those levels. And so in terms of prioritization, what I frankly looked at was the areas that had been weaker in the past and tried to develop them. Because at that stage in 86, 87, 88, when the budget was going up, I honestly felt that we needed to get more involved in the issues of the effects of drugs of abuse on the immune system because of AIDS. That's an area that we've never been researched before, so we put money into that. We needed to do human studies as well as animal studies about how drugs of abuse interacted with the trajectory of HIV infection to AIDS. You know, what happened? I mean, were people who continued to use drugs in some way compromising their immune function and even bringing the full-blown AIDS on earlier? Because at that time we had nothing to help them with. I mean, there were no medications. So we did, those were studies that were brand new. And certainly of a very high priority in the Institute, and we funded a lot of research in that area. But as I say, I also felt that it was essential that we do things, you know, more on a sociological level, with the ethnographers being out there, and people like David Blahov established Man Alive, which was a program in which he interviewed people every 3 months and got blood from them to see when they seroconverted to HIV positive, and tried to counsel them about high-risk sexual behaviors and needle sharing and so forth. So we were doing things on all those fronts. It sounds terrible to say, but the money was coming in so rapidly that we were able to expand in many different areas. Medication Development Division was brand new. We put out a lot of contracts for that.
And who was your first branch chief of that?
Charlie Grzinskas. He came from industry. And the associate director was Frank Bacci, who was a scientist who came from the Food and Drug Administration. And I knew that Charlie Grzinskas would not stay forever because he, you know, was sort of vice presidential material at a pharmaceutical company, and government salaries are such. But he stayed longer than I thought he would. He was there for about 3 or 4 years, and he really enjoyed it. And he's at this meeting.
I noticed.
And he is a private consultant for industry now, a lot in this area. And Frank Bacci, who was associate director, has now taken over that division.
Okay, so the immune system, medications division.
Correct.
Other weaker areas that were strengthened?
Well, I think the area of treatment in general, and particularly behavioral interventions, which is, of course had always been one of my own personal major interests, and we also strengthened the area of laboratory studies in humans of drugs of abuse. In other words, getting to know the human pharmacology of drugs of abuse. That had been done at the ARC, but when they lost the Addiction Research Center at Lexington, it became much more difficult to do that, and we had to diversify in laboratories across the country, so we established a number of labs that were working in that area.
So you diversified by going to the extramural program.
Correct. That's right, because the intramural program did not have the capacity to do the number of studies that we would like to do. The other thing that was coming along during this period was the entire area of brain imaging, which was new, I mean, you know, and very exciting to be able to view the human brain through MRI and PET scanning and so forth.
Do you... go ahead.
No.
I get the one way to tell the story of your life is in part to say that there was a revolution that learning and behavioral pharmacology revolutionized the field, represented a paradigm shift, or at least
a conceptual shift.
Sure. Has that been eclipsed by neurobiology?
Well, that's interesting. I'm writing a chapter right now in the history of behavioral pharmacology. And I think that, well, a couple of things have happened. First of all, a lot of the techniques that are used in by neurobiologists, or as opposed to behavioral pharmacologists, have been taken from behavioral pharmacologists. Now that we are getting into subcellular events, I think that it is extremely exciting. I think that it's absolutely marvelous. Ultimately, however, I believe that, and that's not just in this science, it's in all sciences, that there are, that one cannot, a reductionistic approach can only be so successful. As one moves up levels of integration, at these higher levels of integration, new phenomena emerge that are not reducible to those that are below because of the interaction of these things. And ultimately, no matter how much we understand the enzymatic and protein pathways of this, that, or the other thing in the cell and how they're affected with drugs, we've got to explain the behavior of the intact, integrated organism. The behavior is always right. And it is ultimately the job of the biologist to be able to predict that behavior, because the behavior is the reality. And so I think that, and the behavioral effects of drugs are the reality. Understanding them at different levels is fine. And I'm all in favor. I mean, I'm excited about it. I mean, but we cannot forget that the end product is that we're trying to change people's behavior.
Is there forgetting? Do you, when you look at the field today, do you see forgetting happening?
Well, I think one of the things that, some of the thing, kinds of things that bother me most is that those of us who are behavioral pharmacologists developed a language that was used very precisely. It's been co-opted by everyone, and everybody talks about drugs being reinforcers and uses the term euphoria in the same sentence as if they're synonymous, and they're absolutely not. Absolutely not. So, it leads to sloppy thinking and inaccuracies in terms of the way we conceptualize the problem and our studies. And that's true across the board. There are a lot of terms that when rigorously defined, it's important to maintain the purity of that language. And as I say, it's been co-opted by everyone. And so we hear it used in some strange ways. And I think that's unfortunate. I don't think it does the field any good.
Can you give me some examples of that language?
Well, I think that the issue of using the term euphoria and reinforcement interchangeably leads to the conclusion or the fact that drugs stimulate the pleasure center leads to an almost hedonistic kind of conception of drug abuse. And there is some truth to that. Yes, in fact, drugs do produce positive mood changes and so forth in humans. However, individuals continue to take them under circumstances and at times when there is absolutely no evidence of positive mood changes, and it is highly likely that that the bulk of the times that addicts take drugs not associated with let the good times roll. Mm-hmm. And so this preoccupation with talking about euphoria and positive reinforcement as if they're synonymous, I think leads to sloppy thinking. I think the term craving is one that drives me absolutely nuts, particularly when it's used in the plural. I have my cravings. Craving is an important phenomenon, but it is not necessarily important because it leads to drug taking. There's lots of experimental data and clinical data indicating that, yeah, sometimes craving is followed by drug seeking and drug taking behavior, and a lot of the time it is not. But it is almost taken as if it's a surrogate for the problem of addiction. And I think it is an important phenomenon. One of the ways that craving is important, and I'm not the first person to say this, is that if one is preoccupied in thinking about some commodity that they wish to consume, drug or otherwise, they can't be very productive in thinking about other things. So preoccupation is one of the major downsides of what people call craving. But it certainly is not by any means the sole determinant of drug-taking behavior, and people sort of tend to think that way. There's a lot of clinical studies asking people when they relapsed, did they suffer from extreme craving? And those that are honest say, no. You know, I don't know. I just suddenly, I took the drug. And, you know, the other interesting thing is, I've run groups with addicts over the past years. If you've taken a drug and you have to confess to that, you say, man, I just couldn't help it. I was craving the drug so much. That's almost a justification. And so there's a lot of what we call response demand. I mean, you know, a lot of, it buys you a lot to say you were just overwhelmed with craving as an excuse for, you say, I don't know, I was out last night and I took some cocaine. People are going to look at you as if you're nuts in the group and, you know, really come down on you. But if you say, oh God, I was craving, then they'll say, okay, now we have to deal with why you were craving and so forth, you know.
Great. I mean, one of the things that I've been interested in over the years is the way in which people who use drugs take on some of the language of people who study drugs. There's a kind of...
And vice versa.
Yes. Is that sort of what you're seeing? I mean, now you have people constructing their drug use in terms of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Even.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I think, you know, I think it's very important. One of the reasons why I think it's important to talk about the effects of drugs on the brain is that even though I think that I can discuss very meaningfully the phenomena of drug addiction at a behavioral level, everybody thinks they're an expert in behavior. And to some extent they are. We all have a lot of experience with it. But that doesn't mean that we really understand the determinants of behavior. But people will listen to the experts when they talk about the effects of drugs on the brain. And it tends to remove it from the area of moralism into more of a biological conception of the problem and less, and therefore it's easier to accept it as a disease. My own personal bias is to think of it as a behavioral disorder.
You don't think of it as a disease?
I personally do not. I have sort of a purist notion about the term disease, and it's just, I'm happy for it to be conceptualized that way for pragmatic reasons, for third-party payment, and for a variety, and for selling it to Congress, et cetera. I just, my own personal bias in terms of the way that I find it better to conceptualize it is a behavioral disorder and a public health problem. Now, that's my view. I certainly don't demean those who want to call it a brain disorder, a disease, but it's just not, I don't find it as productive in my own thinking to think of it that way.
Your successor, Alan Leshner, certainly used that to great effect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's what I mean when I say that I think pragmatically it is extremely important. I think it can be conceptualized that way. I simply am saying that for my own, in the way that I want to address and think about how to conceptualize and work on solutions for the problem, I'm getting people right now from third convicted felons for nonviolent crimes sent to my clinic. I just got this contract. Thinking about their problems as a brain disease is not going to help me very much in terms of trying to find solutions to keeping them away from drugs or helping them to stop using drugs and to avoid going back to prison. So that's why I think of it as a behavioral disorder. But that isn't to say that there aren't changes in the brain. I mean, there are, but I just am working at a behavioral level, and therefore it's...
I want to then ask you, because now you've had this nice substantial experience since NIDA, how important do you think the director's priorities are in terms of setting the research agenda?
Well, a little known fact is that it takes many, many years of being there because you have so many carryover grants and you only have so much new money. And particularly, and I feel very sorry for Dr. Nora Volkoff right now because the budget is flat. And it's during the era that I was the director of NIDA and during the time that Dr. Leshner was the director, the budget was increasing at a rapid enough rate that one could begin new initiatives and have a great influence on priorities. It's more difficult when the budget is flat. That doesn't mean it can't be done, but it means you make some enemies. You know, being realistic, I've discussed this with Nora, and I've said, you know, I'm really very sad that you have come into this position at this time because it's not going to be as easy as it was for me and for Alan Leshner. But I think there's no question of the fact that the director of NIDA can have an influence. I go to conferences. And people will come up to me and say, you know, I can't tell you how important it was that I got that grant back when you were the director of NIDA, and I've been continuously funded ever since then. And, you know, I really wasn't successful until you came in. Well, largely that's because I had this extra money. I mean, but to some extent it is also in some areas because I was willing to go out on a limb and to see to it that it was supported. Ming Swang, who did a genetic study, still sees me at the National Academy of Science when I go to the meetings there, IOM, I mean, Institute of Medicine, and says, you know, I can't thank you enough. You got me that large pot of money to do the genetic studies in the twins. And there had been some criticism of it, because he was doing it in a VA population, and people said, well, that's not the normal population, et cetera. And I still felt it was important, that despite the fact that it didn't quite have, it was a little bit out of the funding priority range, I thought it was important enough to fund it, and we did. So, you know, the director can make those kinds of decisions, and sometimes they're right.
I wanted to ask you specifically about genetics, the emergence of genetics, what you make of it. So when I ask people, was there ever any talk about genetics at Lexington. No. You know, never corridor talk, never speculation,
right. Yeah.
Never, you know, those coffee meetings, the morning meetings,
right.
Nothing. When did you begin to hear it percolating, and how did
I think it came in through alcoholism.
Yes.
I mean, alcoholism was the key. And I think that once that was found, people started to say, well, I wonder. And the findings there were fairly robust. And then people began to think, well, perhaps similar findings could be, factors may be operative in other forms of addiction. And my interest in it is how the genotype gets translated into the phenotype. And I can give you a very quick example, and that is that there's a study that has been done by my colleagues, Shepard Kellum and Margaret Ensminger, who were at the University of Chicago, and they looked at about 1,300 first graders for an entire year, observed them in the classroom, got teachers' ratings, got peer ratings, got parents' ratings, and observed them for an entire year, looking for what characteristics of these children might be predictive of later psychiatric and substance abuse problems. And lo and behold, they found that young males who had two characteristics, shyness and aggressiveness, both of which are temperamental things that I think are heavily genetically determined. Not completely, of course, but I think that there is a genetic basis for these. They found that those young men, those young boys, had something like 2.5-3-fold greater preponderance of substance abuse in adolescence. And 25 years later, in a 25-year follow-up where they got over 80% of them, they found it's something like a 2.5-fold greater probability that they had used cocaine in the past year than the males who did not have those characteristics. Now, here's the neat part. Dr. Ensminger is a sociologist, so at adolescence, she not only looked at their drug use and so forth, she did a measure of bonding to school. How important were teachers' opinions, grades, etc.? And lo and behold, it turned out that the kids who were shy and aggressive showed very poor bonding to school. However, if they did show high bonding to school, they had no increased risk for drug abuse. Kids who did not have shyness and aggressiveness, boys who for other reasons failed to bond to school, had the same high risk of drug abuse. It was just that the kids who were shy and aggressive were less likely to get along in the classroom and become bonded to school. So what we have is potentially a temperamental difference that may be in part genetically determined, influencing how children get linked up in their social environment, and that leads to all kinds of consequences. So that's what I mean when I say the genotype leading to the ultimate phenotype of being a drug abuser. I'm intrigued in how that pathway goes, because we may not be able to change the genes. But in this case, we could make extra special effort to get those kids bonded to school.
Yeah.
And that's the answer. I mean, you know, so yeah. That's why I find it neat. So I'm intrigued with genetics and think we do everything we can to find out. But I think a lot of these things are probably genetic predispositions to, I mean, we know the kids with oppositional defiance disorder, conduct disorder, and ADHD are about 3.5-fold more likely to be drug abusers in adolescence. And I'm sure all those things probably have a genetic basis. So I'm intrigued with how the genes actually end up, you know,
yes,
affecting. So
very interesting.
Anyway.
But during your tenure at NIDA, there were you had
we
some,
just started
yeah.
just got really started to be interested, and as I say, we. I think one of the first big grants that we funded was Ming Shuang's twin study in veterans.
All right. What do you think should be the role of drug science in drug policy? I mean, clearly, that's a big question, and it's one that you've spent your career trying to answer.
Well, I think that drug policy, like many policies, is very interesting. I think what we start off with is how the problem is conceptualized, which leads to what I and others have called governing ideas.
Do you know, you don't know my book, probably. It's about what I call governing mentalities. And it's about women. It's called Using Women, Gender, Drug Policy, and Social Justice.
Maybe you'll get it. I will get it.
Governing ideas. Can you tell me what you mean?
Well, okay. If one has the conception that drug abuse is a public health problem, the governing ideas that are generated by that will be those that flow from that conception. If one conceives it as a problem of morality, then the governing ideas will be appropriate for that conception. The governing ideas lead to what I call slogans, such as, if from the morality viewpoint, zero tolerance for drug use, drug-free America, and those kinds of slogans. And those slogans actually are determinative in terms of policy. So if you have zero tolerance for drug use, you can't have a needle exchange program. Okay? It's verboten, because that's not zero tolerance for drug use. You are condoning drug use by doing that. So all the policies flow from these the way it's conceptualized, and then these almost slogan kinds of things that are associated with that. And tragically, it's unfortunate that we're polarized in our views about it between those two, when in fact I'm all in favor of using all the social control mechanisms we can use by saying, hey, you know, use of drugs is a dumb idea. It's bad. It leads to all kinds of social problems and family problems, community problems, so we shouldn't do it. So society has the right to say this is behavior we won't condone, and use all of our social institutions to try and help kids to avoid it or stop it. But once people are using drugs and addicted, then to try and use morality as a way of stopping it no longer works. Then it's a public health problem. We have to address it that way. So that's the problem. It's not either or. It's really on a continuum. And Alan Leshner has said this as well. I wrote a chapter in a book that details all this. But
where?
It's published in a book edited by Griffith Edwards, who is the editor of. Maybe Malcolm later was a co-editor. Leshner has said that, you know, taking a drug the first time is a decision that people can make, and they have to be responsible for that decision. Once they are addicted, then it becomes a brain disease for him.
So what kind of structural or attitudinal shifts would we need if we were going to achieve a more ideal state where drug science and drug policy are more consonant with each other?
Well, I fundamentally believe that one has to understand that whether we like it or not, we are not successful in our prevention activities to the extent we would like to. Some people by virtue of social factors, some people by virtue of their psychiatric status, end up addicted to drugs. And to deal with them as a problem of morality, I think, is a fatal, fatal flaw in the system. We know on the basis of every bit of evidence that if we were to provide the comprehensive treatment, that we could be successful with a large proportion of these people. 100%? No, but a large proportion. And at a lesser cost than we're currently spending to inter them in jail, which in my state costs $31,000 a year. And I get less than $3,000 a year to treat heroin addicts. You know, give me a break. That's just... And if I'm not successful, they're going to end up back in jail, costing us as taxpayers $31,000. So I think that we basically need to have a conceptual a change in the way that the problem is conceptualized. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I think pragmatically viewing this as a brain disease is a good idea. It tends to reduce stigma and so forth. But like many diseases, there are some spontaneous remissions. Some people quit without treatment. And we have to point out that that happens in other diseases as well. But I think that if we could get this public health conception of this and a reorientation of at least some of the monies, not all of them, saying that into demand reduction as opposed to supply reduction, it would go a long way. Right. That's where I want to go.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
It's been very pleasant. You're a great interviewer.